Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
What a fun conversation. Now, Jim Rickards, you should be warned, he knows a lot. He is very good at explaining what he knows. And he's very pessimistic on current prospects with inflation, the economy, and perhaps the markets. I'm a bit more optimistic, but you'll see. I learned a lot in this conversation. And although I think there are more modern innovations than modern plumbing, Jim did school me on quite a few things, and so I learned a lot, and you get to decide for yourself whether optimism or pessimism rules the day.
My wife makes fun of me, saying, when things are fine, everyone loses my number, and then when the wheels come off, the phone doesn't stop ringing. So right now I'm busier than ever. So
yeah, because, you know, I think it's just a phenomenon of the markets that when the markets are going up, everybody is individually a genius. But when the markets are going down, the people who are geniuses are the ones who are pessimists, or correctly or incorrectly. So there's a lot of people who have good data when the market's down and make good predictions. But it's funny, when the markets are going up, people lose my number. And when the markets are going down, people laugh at me.
Yeah, I mean, during Trump, all you do is buy a passive index fund and sit back and, you know, enjoy the ride. So, but now you actually have to think about what you're doing.
Well, what was happening in the economy? Like, you know, the markets went up during the Obama years, obviously, but they were like hyper-accelerated during the Trump years. And part of it, of course, was that half of his administration, or part of his administration, was under COVID. So that there was this stimulus package. But what else was going on then?
Well, you know, if you look at the data, I'm sure you do, GDP growth in the Trump years was not different than Obama. I mean, the whole period from 2000, now COVID was different, so you got to put 2020 in a separate category. But 2009 to 2019, which includes all of Obama practically, and then 3 out of 4 years of Trump, average growth was 2.2% per annum. And it didn't deviate a lot from that. Trump had, I don't think they had 1 year or 3%. It was, you know, 2.9, maybe 3 1 year, a couple quarters, not even a whole year. So it just stayed in that range, but there wasn't a lot of variation around the range. It was like, you know, 1 year might be 1.9 and 2.3. That was just 2.2 for 12 years for both administrations. So the idea of the booming economy under Trump was not true, but the stock market went up a lot. That was true. So that in my view was a bubble dynamic. And we all know how bubbles end, but the thing about bubbles, they can go on longer than you think. I mean, everyone says, you know, the Fed says they don't try to pop bubbles because they can never be sure if it's a bubble or just a good, strong market, and they don't want to be responsible for it. This is the Greenspan theory, but it goes all the way back to 1929. They say, we'd rather let bubbles take their course and clean up the mess than try to pop them and maybe cause a new Great Depression. So, but to me, bubbles are the easiest thing to spot. Just look at a chart. I mean, you know, a Nikkei in 1989, a NASDAQ in 1999, dare I say Bitcoin, et cetera. So you can see bubbles a mile away, and you can be sure they're going to break, and you can be sure they're going to go down 70, 80%. What you're not sure of is when they pop. That's hard to tell. And I certainly wouldn't short a bubble because you can lose a lot of money being right. But they do pop and they go down, and that part's pretty predictable. So we haven't, this break is a little different. I mean, the NASDAQ, I was like, oh, it's been going down since May. Well, actually, the break started in November 2021.
November was kind of the high point for like every market. I'm curious, was there a PE multiple expansion from 2009 to now?
There was through 2020. It's been leveled off a little bit, but that's also bogus because, yeah, there was a PE expansion, but you know, it's price earnings. But what's your E? In other words, are you looking at like a Shiller Cape ratio, or are you looking at Wall Street? Because Wall Street does expected earnings. They have projected earnings. Right. And I think the earnings are in for a huge correction this year, meaning, yeah, you've got a PE ratio, but by inflating the E, you get like a ratio that doesn't look too bad. But if you correct the E for what's actually going to happen, the ratios are off the charts. That's the benefit of Shiller's ratio. It's backward looking, but it goes with 10 years, you're going through at least one, maybe two and a half business cycles. And that's why it's a more meaningful number.
Yeah. Also, the other thing that's interesting is if you kind of adjust for the increase in the money supply, the stock market hasn't moved since 2020, actually. Like if you normalize, like if you say, okay, the money supply increased 40%, guess what? So did the stock market. The stock market just, like, there was just additional money in the economy because of all the bailouts and COVID, and that kind of went into the stock market.
Yeah, until late 2021, there wasn't much inflation. I mean, the stuff in your money printing leads to inflation is nonsense. They actually have very little to do with each other because of velocity, which is a separate variable, a separate factor. But the money goes somewhere. And it was not going into inflation, but it was going into assets. You saw it in real estate and stocks. So now that's deflating, but we have inflation. We have everyday inflation.
I mean, the ideal is if it goes into industry. So like if money fuels innovations, which to some extent it did. I mean, there's been innovations in biotech, technology, genomics, you know, automated vehicles, all these things. But what always bothers me about the market, and again, I'm in general an optimist. I own stocks. I believe in good companies. But what always bothers me about the market is that in the very beginning of when a company goes public, the entire reason it goes public is largely a scam. Like the venture capitalists have funded it all the way up, and now they just need to cash out. And so they have to. They can't send it to other venture capitalists because they're like, hey, why don't you invest in it? We don't want to take your garbage. But you know who will take it is the public. So an initial public offering is the venture capitalist saying, hey, the greater fool is Main Street America. So let's get rid of this piece of garbage that we have and move on.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I'm not, there's some innovation and some great technology going on. I'm not sure I agree that even to the extent money's been available, it's been routed to really productive things. You know, the last great innovations were things like, you know, indoor plumbing, electricity.
The internet is a big innovation.
Okay, I'll give the internet a little credit, but that's about it. But, you know, the electric vehicle was invented in 1837. In 1905, 90% of the taxis in New York were electric vehicles. In the 1950s, 100% of the East German Postal Service were electric vehicles. They're basically golf carts. But there's a reason they never caught on. And the reason is batteries. It's that simple. An electric engine is very simple, high maintenance, accelerates really fast, has a lot of things going for it. But you remember like a 19th century locomotive, there was a coal car behind it and you shovel the coal in to keep the engine going. You should have one of those.
You might remember that from your childhood. I don't quite remember
that. My family are four generations on the railroad, so I know a little bit about trains. But that's one of the reasons I loved Atlas Shrugged. I thought it was a good railroad story. But that's what a Tesla should have, because everyone's like plugging their Tesla into the grid like the electricity is coming out of the sky. It's coming from coal-burning plants. 55% of the electricity in China is from coal. That number is increasing. They're the largest user of electronic vehicles. And if it's not coal, it's like oil or natural gas. So the idea that you have an emission-free vehicle, no, because you're charging it with electricity that comes from plants that emit CO2. We actually need a little more CO2, by the way. We're gonna kill the plants at the rate we're going. We should probably expand our CO2 emissions. But the electric cars, I mean, they work. I'm not saying you can't get around to one. Of course you can. But at the end of the day, the greatest fuel or the greatest energy generating capacity by weight, other than uranium, is gasoline or kerosene, which is jet fuel. So you can get power out of a battery. I actually own and built the largest non-commercial off-grid solar field in New England.
Really?
So, yeah. So I said, Greta, and I have 75 acres of trees. So Greta Thunberg has nothing on me.
So let me ask, can I ask you a couple of questions? So where are your solar panels? They are on the ground or on a...
They're on the ground. I had to clear 3 acres, and I get all these nuts and go, oh, why do you have to clear 3 acres to put up solar panels? I said, well, I don't live in the desert. We have trees. I don't want a tree to fall on my solar panels. But I have 9 steel towers. They're 15 by 9 feet each. Each one has 9, 3x5 solar panels on it. So,
and how much can you store up if you wanted to store?
Well, it all depends how many batteries you buy, but the batteries are very expensive. So it's 7.5 kilowatt hours of output. I run one house on it. Now it's a decent sized house, but still one house. So it's like, I know I learned a few things. Number one, they don't work at night. They don't work in the rain and the snow.
In the winter, they don't work so well.
Well, it depends on the weather. But I get about, everyone says, oh, you run your house on solar power. It's like, no, I run my house on batteries. And the batteries are charged by the solar panels. That's how it works. But I get about 3 days.
That's what I hear, that you can't. I have a neighbor who's all solar paneled, and he gets about 3 days he could store.
Yeah, you actually, it's interesting because humans are very adaptable. You adapt your lifestyle. So on a sunny day, it's use it or lose it. I get more power than I can use. So that's the day, washing machine, dishwasher, dryer, all that stuff. Run all that stuff on a sunny day, and you won't, on net, you won't use any electricity because you're generating more than you're using.
But, solar energy is something that where there's innovation. I mean, every year, solar panel efficiency goes up by a factor of 4. It's like one of these exponentially growing. There's a variety of exponentially growing industries. Solar panel industry is one of them. And that's where there's some innovation.
Yeah, there's some. Like I said, I own one. But it's really not scalable. There is innovation. And you can't run a grid on it because it's intermittent for exactly the reasons I mentioned. In other words, I've got a lot of batteries. I've got 20 large, they're made by Sony, they're top line. I don't have any Chinese parts anywhere. My panels are from Canada. My batteries are from Japan. All the work was obviously a local labor. But I avoid China, to the greatest extent possible. It's impossible to avoid it completely, but I try not to buy any Chinese parts. But no, it works great. I'm a fan. I'm also an expert because I build it. But my point being, you cannot run a power grid on it. It's intermittent power.
Right.
It's a supplement. It's a supplement. It'll play a role. It'll grow. I agree with that. But we're on oil and natural gas, whether you like it or not, period.
Yeah. But just to the point of innovation, wouldn't you say there's also been innovation in genomics, like gene editing, things like that? Like, and that's another exponentially growing industry, which, 10, 15 years from now, if it keeps growing at the rate it's growing, like major diseases that people thought were hopeless to solve are going to be solved.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it depends how. So for example, these, Pfizer, Moderna vaccine, I mean, they're not really vaccines. They're experimental gene modification treatments. They don't work. 5 million people in December, 2021, I follow this closely. I wrote a book on it actually, but in December, 2021, 5 million people who were double vaxxed and boosted got Omicron. So I wrote my book in 2020. I said the vaccines don't work, but how much more proof do you need? 5 million double vax boosted people got Omicron. It obviously proves, but we knew already that it doesn't stop infection and it doesn't stop spread. They do reduce or mitigate extreme symptoms in highly vulnerable individuals. So if you're 70 years old and you're obese, or you have diabetes, or you have asthma or chronic pulmonary obstruction disease, and you want to take it voluntarily, it could save your life, but that's because it mitigates symptoms. It doesn't stop you from getting infected, and it doesn't stop the spread. It was all nonsense.
If someone's vaccinated and they get it, do they have fewer chances to spread because they're not coughing as much, for instance?
No. First of all, the virus goes where it wants. That's exactly what we saw in December 2021. But like I said, the evidence was plentiful before that. And by the way, this is going to have a huge impact. It is having a huge impact in China because The vaccine for COVID is to get COVID. The way to beat COVID is to get COVID. Survival rate is about 99.8%. And you get it and you generate real antibodies, effective antibodies, and your chance of getting it again is not zero, but it's much lower. So the way you beat COVID is by getting COVID. COVID is the vaccine for COVID. It's called herd immunity. It worked in the US, Brazil, UK, and Europe. Now, the one major country that has not allowed that to happen is China. They've got this zero COVID policy, which makes no sense. You might as well say zero colds. You know, we're gonna shut down cities of 26 million people at a time because somebody has a cold. That's what they're doing. I mean, I know I say it that way, it makes it sound absurd, but it is absurd. But that's what they're doing. Now, in a communist society, you can do that. So they shut down Shanghai, 26 million people. I mean, if you get a couple of cases in a place like Shanghai, they shut down the neighborhood. They have COVID concentration camps. They move you out there. They physically, forcibly move you to one of these camps. Then if it's a little larger than that, like in a neighborhood or a whole building, they shut down that part of the neighborhood. And then beyond that, they shut down the entire city. They have... you have, you know, your iPhone, you have a QR code, it's red, yellow, green, and they control it. They tell you what your code is. You got to get tested once a week, if not more frequently. You cannot go outside, you cannot travel, et cetera, et cetera. And so they're like, we're going to beat it. Because you can't beat it, but they go through the pretense. So then they wake up one day and there's like, okay, 4 days in a row, no new cases. All right. So Shanghai is now reopening and then, you know, the Chinese stock market goes up because it's over. But then like 3 weeks go by and then you get a couple more cases and they do it again. So it's whack-a-mole at very, very high cost. And this will not change before the 20th National Party Congress in November at the earliest, because that's when Chairman Xi will be anointed as the new Mao Zedong. He'll be the first president to get a third term, but de facto, he'll be president for life. Xi Jinping thought with, you know, Chinese characteristics for a new age, as they call it, is the equivalent of Mao's Red Book. So they're doing everything possible to elevate him. He's not going to either admit he was wrong or change policy before then, at the earliest, maybe not even then. So, and China's going to show zero growth this year, zero.
Yeah, and that might even be fake. Like, we know they're having major real estate collapses and a lot of problems. But China's an interesting thing because, let's say right now, you know, all the headlines are about inflation, but there's really two kinds of inflation. There's the monetary inflation from the Federal Reserve printing all this extra stimulus money, and there's the supply chain inflation where there's simply limited supplies of things, for instance, that were made in China. And when there's lower supply and demand remains the same, price goes up. So there's these two kinds of inflation. The Federal Reserve could really only handle one of them, which is the monetary inflation. They can really do very little on the supply side. And what's going to happen, you think?
Well, first of all, I agree that there are two sources of inflation. One, you're right, James, that you know, supply side, so-called cost push inflation, coming from, you know, energy shortages, supply chain disruption, can't get fertilizer out of Russia, so we can't plant crops. We're diverting corn to supply diesel with higher, synthetic components in diesel. Well, that means there's not enough corn to feed the pigs and the cows. And so the price of meat goes up. So that's all connected. It's all falling apart. Comes from the supply side. The other side is called demand pull inflation. It comes from individuals and it's, but there's no evidence that inflation expectations have anything to do with it. What does matter, and the Fed, it's just one more example of how the Fed is always wrong and they look at the wrong things. They do look at inflation expectations. People poll it and they gauge it. The best evidence is it has nothing to do with inflation. What does have to do with inflation are current expectations. You wake up in the morning, you decide, you see inflation all around you, and you say, well, you know, I was thinking of buying a refrigerator. I better go buy it now before the price goes up, or a new car, or, you know, suit of clothes or whatever. I lived through that. That's the way it was in the late 1970s. And that's the way we did things. We said, I better go buy it now because I know the price is going to go up. But that's very real time. I mean, it's and we're not there yet. We're dangerously close. And that feeds on itself, and it's very hard to break. Monetary policy has nothing to do with it. That's a myth sort of launched by Milton Friedman, but there's no correlation.
But there's got to be some truth to it. Like during these bailouts, there's no evidence
for that.
People had no money somehow ended up with hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they finally bought the car they wanted to buy. They bought the clothes they wanted to buy.
That's not monetary policy. That's fiscal policy that came from the Congress. As far as monetary policy, so in 2008, the Federal Reserve balance sheet was $800 billion. And in 2014, at the end of the taper, it was $4.5 trillion. Okay, so the money supply went up by 400%, and there was no appreciable inflation that entire time. So there is no correlation between money supply, base money, and inflation.
But could you argue that there was the money was used towards economic goods? So if money is put into the economy,
it wasn't. But there's no evidence for that, James. I hear what you're saying. This is just warmed over Milton Friedman, and he was wrong about this. I'll tell you why he was wrong. What he missed was velocity. In other words, you know, the quantity theory of money, but the guy who got it right was Irving Fisher. But it's, you know, it's money supply times velocity equals nominal GDP, and nominal GDP has two parts, a price index and real. Okay, that's the whole thing. So Friedman said, and here's where he got it right. He said a modern industrial economy like the United States, or service economy, but a developed economy, can really only grow about 3.5% a year, and that's about right. You know, give or take. If you have more than that, it's because you're coming out of a recession or some slack, and yeah, you grow 5-6% per year, but that's about it. You can do worse than that because of bad policy, but 3.5% is about right. So, and you don't want inflation. You want P, which is the price index, to be one. In other words, you don't want inflation or deflation in a perfect world. You want price stability. So if real can grow 3.5% and you want price inflation to be one, that means nominal grows 3.5%. And then he went over to the other side of the equation. He assumed velocity was constant. And so he said, all you have to do is dial up the money supply or dial it down. You don't need a board of governors. You just need a computer to do that. And you can have nirvana, which is maximum growth, no inflation. Where Friedman was wrong was that velocity is not constant. It was during most of his career. I mean, to be fair, from 1950 to 1980, velocity was pretty constant. But you go back, you know, take a longer time series, look at the Great Depression, look at the 1920s, look at the aftermath of World War I, et cetera, or look at the last 10 years. Velocity has collapsed. And so all of the Fed's money printing is okay, money supply is going up to offset the crash of velocity. Velocity looks like a Red Bull cliff dive.
But part of velocity going down, and so by velocity, just a very simple explanation is, if I buy a newspaper from the newspaper guy with a dollar, he takes the dollar, buys a flour, the flour guy takes the dollar, buys a coffee, $1 costs $3 to be spent. That's correct. Velocity. And correct. Part of the collapse of velocity, though, has to do, and this happened, we could see this directly during COVID, has to do with the internet. Like, money would arrive in an urban area, for instance, and immediately go to Seattle because people were buying stuff on Amazon. No one was buying things in stores.
You're right. But that money is helicopter money from fiscal policy. That is not monetary policy. Here's how monetary policy works. When the Fed wants to increase the money supply, QE, let's say, they buy bonds from primary dealers, right, which are the big banks. They call Goldman Sachs, offer me 10-year notes. Okay, done. Goldman delivers the 10-year note to the Fed, and the Fed pays for it with money from thin air. Okay, but what does Goldman or Citi, I don't pick on Goldman, JP Morgan, anybody else, what do they do with the money? They gave it back to the Fed as excess reserves. That money never entered the real economy. The only money that could enter the real economy is either commercial bank credit creation, which was very stale, very tame, or, and I think this is really what you're referring to, is fiscal policy. Those handouts made a big difference. You're right about that. The Trump, June 2020, Trump handed out the $1,400 checks. And then December 2020, just before he left office, there was a $600 check. And Biden comes in and says, I'll see your $1,400, raise your $1,400.
The corporate bailouts gave a lot of people who were dead broke. I mean, there was so much scam during correct. The corporate bailouts that it by itself was trillions of dollars.
Correct. No, you're absolutely right. But that was not monetary policy. That was fiscal policy. That was helicopter money. It was coming from the Congress.
Well, with the monetary policy, though, what I worry about is when they're buying at the outer end of the curve. So they're not just buying like T-bills. They're buying, 10-year mortgage derivatives, or even some have suggested they could have been buying stocks to keep things going.
Well, there's no evidence that they bought stocks, but as far as 10-year notes and mortgages and all that, you're right. But I run into people all the time, you know, like yourself. I'm, you know, speaker of conferences and all that. And people banging the table. We got to stop the money printing. Like, the Fed's not printing money. The Fed's burning money right now. They stopped. I forget if it was QE6 or QE7. I lost track, but they stopped increasing the money supply last November. They started decreasing the money supply, so-called quantitative tightening, in March. And they are not only are they not buying securities, which is how they create money, base money anyway, M0, they're selling securities, which, and when you pay them for the securities, that money disappears. It's the opposite of QE. It's called QT. And then somebody, you know, it's amazing how bad analysis is, you know, whether it's Bloomberg or all these guys. Somebody said, well, the Fed's not really doing QT because look at it. They didn't sell any securities. It's like they don't have to sell them. They just let them mature.
Right. That's what they said, is that basically starting June 1st, they were going to let the bonds mature and then they just weren't going to buy anymore.
If I have a 2-year note that's 2 years old and it matures, the Fed just sends me the money. I don't have to sell it. And if you just do that and don't roll it over, that's the key thing. Don't buy a new one. The balance sheet will shrink, and it is shrinking. So right now the Fed is destroying money. They're not creating money. It doesn't matter because all that money didn't go anywhere anyway. It just went back to the Fed in the form of excess reserves, and they were paying interest on excess reserves. That didn't do anything, but fiscal policy did. The Congress helicopter money under the influence of modern monetary theory. I doubt there are two members of Congress who can tell you what modern monetary theory is, but it doesn't matter. They're all doing it. That is the policy, the fiscal policy of the United States today, which is MMT.
And the Congress is still helicoptering money down. Like, you know, they're considering forgiving $10,000 of student loan debt to the millions of people who have student loan debt. Like, that's a form of helicoptering money down. Like,
sure. We'll have $100 billion to Ukraine. That'll mostly be recycled to the Democratic Party. I mean, that's
right. And people don't realize that when a dollar is spent, even abroad, it could only come back here. You could only really spend a dollar back here. So if you give $100 billion to Ukraine, they have to spend the money eventually back here.
That's right. First of all, a lot of the money to Ukraine, I'll put that in quotes, doesn't even get spent. We pay Raytheon, you know, for weapons, and we ship them to Ukraine sometimes if they don't get diverted to the black market through Bulgaria in the meantime. But, you know, then the Ukrainian oligarchs have to buy new houses in Miami and Dubai and places like that. They've got to skim, you know, 20-30% off the top. I used to work in the Congo. In you know, the old days, 30% skim was normal, except for Mobutu, who took 50%. But we used to actually price that into we did jumbo loans. I was at Citibank at the time, and we used to price that in. But yes, yeah, so the Ukrainians are skimming, or the money is going to Raytheon or Northrop Grumman before it even gets to Ukraine. We ship the weapons, the Russians blow them up, and you know, wash, rinse, and repeat. But that is real money. You're right. We're spending it at Raytheon. Somebody's getting a job out of it.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX is track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I wonder what's going on now with the markets, you know, every market basically, is that I wonder if secretly the Federal Reserve realizes they can't do anything. For 10 years, they wanted to increase inflation. There was actually probably deflation before COVID. They couldn't do it. They were. I asked a Fed Reserve governor, what's the one thing that keeps Powell up at night? The fact that there's probably deflation, like hidden deflation in the economy and not inflation. They were desperate for inflation, which is why they raised the target higher than 2%. Now there's runaway inflation. They don't know how it happened, and they know they can't. They know they know nothing. So what my theory is, and I'm wondering if you agree with this, they're talking a meme game. They said there might be a hard landing. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. They've done basically almost nothing yet, and like you said, even what they do has no effect. And so, but their words have an effect on whether people buy stocks or not, or buy goods or not. And I wonder if what their plan is to reduce the wealth of the economy so much that that in itself stops inflation. So the stock market has gone down $10 trillion worth. Will that decrease in the nation's wealth reduce inflation?
No. There's very little evidence for the wealth effect. All these things that they teach you in economics. I actually struggled in economics when I was an undergraduate. Yeah, I got okay grades, but it wasn't my strongest subject. And I kept like, hey, what's wrong with me? I don't get it. I'm getting A's and everything else. I just don't get this. But it took me like 20 or 30 years to realize everything I was taught was garbage. And so I say, oh, well, once you understand you're being taught garbage, it makes sense that I didn't get it. But I kind of figured it out on my own. So there is no wealth effect. The evidence for that is very, very weak. There's no correlation between money supply and inflation. The evidence for that is weak. Throw in velocity, yes. If you, your example, you know, the example you gave was velocity of three. $1 creates $3 of goods and services.
The velocity thing is very important because velocity occurs the most in urban areas because that's where you could spend a dollar multiple times. So a city like New York City or Chicago normally would have a high velocity effect. But with COVID, this is why cities are essentially destroyed right now because cities lived off of velocity and they made taxes. They made all their revenues off of the velocity of money. And mayors don't realize this. I don't know how cities that are like New York City requires $100 billion to run the city every year. I don't know how they're going to ever make that kind of money again. There's zero velocity of money in cities now.
Well, you're right about that, but they need to rely on Democratic presidents who are going to, you know, basically give them money, which is what's happened in the original $2 trillion bill that Biden did get passed. You forget the name of it, American Rescue Act or whatever it was. So he handed out some pretty big checks to New York and California, which is to be expected. It's really important not to confuse asset inflation and price inflation. Because if I put money in the stock market, I bid up stocks and, you know, 100 million people do the same thing. You can get a stock bubble, but that's not velocity. That money's not, it's just, we're just trading stocks, right?
But don't you think if people say, oh, my portfolio used to be worth 100,000, now it's worth 500,000. Don't you think that's going to make it easier for them to make a decision like, oh, I'm going to buy a house or I'm going to buy a Tesla or whatever?
Not really. There's no evidence for that. They may or may not buy a house for a Tesla, but I'm enough of a geek that I actually read these peer-reviewed papers coming out of the economics profession. The funny thing about the Fed, the Board of Governors, and I know a lot of them, I know you do too, they're clueless. And the staff in Washington are pretty weak. They're caught up in really flawed models. But if you go to the regional reserve banks, you know, San Francisco, St. Louis, New York, to a lesser extent, you can find some good research in some of these, you know, juniors and mid-level people. But they've shown, again, that the wealth effect is very weak. It's very attenuated. And if I buy assets, that's fine. And the asset goes up, maybe buy a bottle of champagne or something, but it really doesn't affect spending that much. What does affect spending is your confidence in the future, inflation. If you think inflation is a driver, you will go out and spend more money, and that feeds on itself.
What about employment? What's the employment factor in inflation? Because usually the Fed gets nervous whenever unemployment's too low.
Well, yeah, but there again, they've got it wrong, because what they're ignoring is labor force participation. So the employment report came out Friday, and everyone looks at the unemployment rate. I don't. I mean, I see it, okay. But I look at the labor force participation, which went down again. And by the way, it's been going down for 10 years. It peaked at 70. It's never going to be 100. You know, there's good reason some people are not in the workforce. They're homemakers, or they're students, or they're, you know, there could be a lot of reasons for some. But it boomed in the 80s, 90s, mainly because women were entering in the early 2000s, because women were entering the workforce, which is a good thing. But now it's collapsed. It's gone round numbers from 70 to 61. It's poking around 61, 62.
Where is everybody? Like, everybody says since COVID, oh, we can't hire people anymore. There's nobody around. Like, whether I talk to hotels, restaurants, airlines, every industry, where did everybody go? Where is they all just moving with their parents?
They're on the couch eating Doritos, living with their parents, and watching NBA playoffs. I mean, they're some of it's early retirement, and you know, and then so the, you know, the CNBC types are like, well, it's not really that people don't want to work, this early retirement. It doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, okay, I'll buy that, but it doesn't matter if you're able-bodied. I'm talking about able-bodied individuals between the ages of 25 and 54. That's the prime workforce. There are approximately 10 million people in that category who are not in the labor force.
And where are they? What, like, are they really just like, did they just cut all costs and they're doing nothing now? Like, what are they? Or are
some are, you know, have working spouses. Some are living with their parents. Some are, you know, just coasting. Some are not extravagant lifestyles. Like you say,
let's say they cut corners then. Like, let's say now they went from a double income family to a single income.
Yeah.
Why is inflation up? Aren't they spending less?
Well, no, inflation is up for the reason we mentioned, which is the supply side. This is not demand pull inflation. This is cost push inflation. It's coming from the supply side. Now, here's the danger. I mean, inflation is inflation. Price is going up. You know, if you got a Ford F-150, instead of $70 to fill up your truck, it's $150. And by the way, that's $80 less to take your spouse out to dinner that weekend. So it's destroying demand or consumer discretionary spending in other categories, because you need, you know, that's the other thing with the employment report. You know, it's like wages up 5.1%. Everyone's like, hey, wages are up 5.1%. That's a nominal number. Okay, with 8.6% inflation, wages up 5.1%, real wages went down 3.5% on an annualized basis. So real wages are going down once you adjust for inflation. And you have to put gas in your truck, and you got to put food on the table to some extent. And to the extent that costs more and real wages are going down, which they are, then you have less for everything else. entertainment, travel, vacation, casinos, clothes, where tuition or, somewhere valuable things. You just don't have the money. And that's why we're in a recession. One of the questions I get, I do a lot of interviews, and the question I get asked most frequently is, Jim, do you think Fed policy is going to cause a recession? And as recently as a few months ago, I would say, well, actually, I do. And I expect that late this year, maybe early next year. Let's watch for that. But now I just say, we're in a recession. I mean, we're in it. First quarter GDP, that's in the books, down 1.6%. Second quarter GDP, the second quarter is over. We won't have the number till the end of July, but we have very good estimates from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and their GDP now. It's not perfect, but it's the best forecasting tool I've seen. And as of now, with the quarter over, but not quite all the data in, they're showing negative 1.9 for the second quarter.
Well, and let me ask you this.
That's two consecutive quarters. You're in the recession right now.
And this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but do you think GDP is a good measure, or is a better measure GDI, gross domestic income, which is actually what we make as a country as opposed to the value of what we produce?
Well, then you have to get into, look, there are other measures. Yeah, GDI, the French have developed well-being or happiness metrics.
Right. Well, that's like a BS metric, though. But like GDI is actually what humans are making. Like that's our income as a country.
Well, yeah. So real or nominal. I mean, again, you have to adjust for inflation. And, you have to also adjust for jobs. I mean, if you're putting all the jobs overseas, or you also have to look at it on a per capita basis. I was in I was talking to Saki Kibata-san. I don't know if you remember him, but he was deputy finance minister of Japan during the 80s. He was known as Mr. Yen. That was his nickname. And I said, we're having lunch in Korea, and I said, Saki Kibata-san, Japan has had eight recessions since 1989. They have. And net deflation, a little inflation here and there, but really not much, and not much growth, just kind of flatlining. It's really a long depression is the best way to describe it. Yeah, but meanwhile, the debt to GDP ratio is like approaching 300%. He goes, Rickerson, he said, you have to understand, those are all gross numbers, but when you do it on a per capita basis, we're actually doing much better. And he was right, of course. I knew that the population was declining, and so that their per capita numbers look better than their gross numbers because the population is declining. So I said, so where this ends up is that there's one person left in Japan and they own the whole country. He's the richest guy in the world. Now that was the reductio ad absurdum, but that's one way of thinking about economic growth. And I agree there are other ways to measure it. Some are better than others, but I always, it's like the inflation hawks, this guy, John Taylor, I guess he has an alternate measure of inflation that shows it's much higher than the government says. And it's good. I mean, I look at his research, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's not a bad way to think about it, but the Fed doesn't care. If you're trying to forecast policy and you're trying to say what the Fed's going to do and the impact that's going to have on markets, whether you agree or not, you have to look at the metrics the Fed is looking at. Otherwise, you got to put yourself, and this is how you do intelligence analysis. You got to put yourself in the other guy's shoes. It doesn't take your opinion, put it to one side. Take your biases, put those to the other side. Put yourself in the other guy's shoes and figure out what he's going to do. If you're trying to forecast, then get back to reality and figure out what's going to happen next. Fed doesn't care about John Taylor. They look at they look at PCE deflator core. But I agree there are other ways to measure it. And but the other problem with GDI is income distribution is. We make Mexico look like an egalitarian society. It's, the old joke, I'm sure you've heard it, 50 guys in a bar and Bill Gates walks in and on average, everyone's a billionaire. Well, that's a true statement, but it didn't mean everyone else got richer.
That's a good point. And so again, what do you think, like right now, the markets have been going down since November. Is that because of and you're alluding that it's not the quantitative tightening, it's kind of the supply shocks that have been hitting the economy post-COVID and also the war with Ukraine. Again, the Fed really has nothing to do with anything, but they're talking a mean game. And I feel like the market has been affected by the Federal Reserve's talk, and that has reduced the wealth of the country. But you're saying the wealth effect doesn't really affect inflation. It's more these supply shocks that we're going through right now.
So velocity is the key explanatory variable in the quantity theory of money, then you go to the next level and say, okay, what affects velocity? And the answer is psychology. Going back to your velocity three example, if I'm feeling good and I go out to dinner tonight and drinks on me and I'm spending money left and right, that's one state of the world. But if I'm staying home watching TV, keep my money in the bank, my velocity is zero in that example. I always remind people, people worry about the money supply. I go, where I went to school, 7 trillion times zero is zero. If you don't have velocity, you don't have an economy.
And my guess is the velocity, and maybe you could tell me this is not correct, does velocity at all correlate to the markets? Like if the stock market loses 25% of its value, I have to think drinks aren't on me anymore for the average person. So there must be some effect on velocity.
It can be. I mean, that's a good example. The simplest way to put it, it's psychological. So what affects psychology? Well, the answer is a lot of things. it could be, I woke up, first news I headline is, the former prime minister of Japan's assassinated. People are saying Abe. I'm like, who's Abe? I mean, I know who Shinzo Abe is, of course, but I'm thinking it sounds Middle Eastern. I was shocked that it happened in Japan. That doesn't happen in Japan. But of course it did, sadly, with a homemade gun. That's another, we don't have to get into gun control, but people want guns, they'll make their own. But that's, you get shocks like that and people get a little, between crime in the big cities, the surrender in Afghanistan, the Russians are winning in Ukraine, that's very clear. I don't know who's going to break that to the American people. You read the New York Times, you would think that the Ukrainian flag is flying over Moscow. But if you read, if you look at Telegraph and, some retired military officers have been pretty candid. The Swiss actually are a good source because they're the thing about people don't understand about Switzerland, everybody has a machine gun under his bed. Like the whole country is armed. Every parking lot in Switzerland is a bomb shelter. They haven't been invaded in 500 years, and there's a reason for that. But they do volunteer, retired military in Switzerland, which is basically the whole country, volunteers peacekeepers. So they, which is not an easy job. You're between two warring armies trying to keep a lid on things. So some of the Swiss retired colonels have been peacekeepers in Eastern Ukraine and other hairy areas. They know what they're talking about. So there are some good sources out there, but you really have to look for them. But Russia's winning. They're winning on the ground and they're winning the economic war. And I did, not all, but a lot of what I did for the intelligence community involved financial warfare. That was they didn't need me to jump out of a helicopter with a knife between my teeth, but they needed financial expertise. And that's what I did. So I know a lot about.
Like, what would they have you do?
Well, basically financial warfare. We did a war game, but I did a lot with a group called CFIUS. And you say CFIUS, and people go, does that, itch or burn? But it stands for the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. So it is an interagency committee. It's hosted at the Treasury. And they get to look at foreign acquisitions of U.S. companies, not from an antitrust or other point of view, but from a national security point of view. And you can say no to them, depending on all the facts. Well, the Treasury, Defense Department, State Department, Commerce are the main inputs. There's some other agencies involved. But they outsource the national security review to the intelligence community. The intelligence community can't say yes or no, but they report back, is this a hostile buyer? Is it a covert operation of some sort? Is there a threat to national security? What, et cetera. So that's the work I did. But I had a front row seat in terms of that whole process. But my point being, when Wally Adeyemo, he's the deputy secretary of the Treasury in charge of saying, Janet Yellen has no clue. Janet Yellen she's a high IQ statistics geek from Berkeley. She knows nothing about the economy. But this guy, Wally Adeyemo, who has never had a real job, he he's got the usual Yale, Harvard diplomas and all that, all that credentialism, but worked as a junior in the National Security Council. And then he carried Larry Fink's briefcase for a year. And then he was president of the Obama Foundation. Now he's deputy secretary of the Treasury. He knows how to throw on sanctions, and he's throwing them on left and right. Every single one of them has backfired. And I teach financial warfare at the U.S. Army War College. I said to my class, I was there at end of April, beginning of May, down in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I said, all these sanctions are going to fail. they're already failing, but you know they're going to get worse. So let me.
How do you measure failing?
Well, for example, I'll give you a concrete example. So Biden said we're going to seize all the oligarch assets, but and Boris Johnson was worse. But we're going to seize all the oligarch assets. So we're seizing yachts, we're seizing townhouses in Belgravia, you know, freezing bank accounts, et cetera, as if that's going to punish the Russians. What they don't understand is that Putin's base of support, it's the military, intelligence community, the Orthodox Church, and everyday people. That's his base. He hates the oligarchs. He considers the oligarchs to be a rival power center. Now, he told them, 10, 15 years ago, he said, he put a couple in jail, just as an example to the rest, but he said, you can keep your money, but keep out of politics. And if you go into politics, you're going to end up in jail or worse or dead. He doesn't mess around. So that was the deal. But he doesn't like oligarchs. He considers them rivals. So we're doing his dirty work for him. He would love to seize all those assets. We're doing it for him. And by the way, guess what the oligarchs are doing? They're bringing capital back to Russia because that's the new safe haven if you're a Russian oligarch. So that's a favor to Putin. He should send Biden a thank you note. Russian revenues for oil and natural gas are at all-time highs. The ruble, everyone's like, oh, it's back where it was before the war started. No, it's stronger than before the war started. When the war started, it was about 80 to 1. It dipped to 140 for about a minute, rallied back to 80. Today, it's like, I think it was like 65 bids, 67 offered or something. I mean, it's actually getting too strong. My friend, Vera Nabiullina, she's the head of the Central Bank of Russia. She's the only central banker in the world who knows her job, knows how to run a central bank. She's going to cut interest rates because she's got to weaken the ruble a little bit because it's now getting a little too strong. Russia now has a monopoly on Ukrainian grain. There's a big uproar. Russia's stealing the grain from Ukraine and selling it to Syria. Well, they were. But that's what happens in a war. When you win, you get to keep stuff. I mean, why is that shocking? Oh, so Russia took over like a third of Ukraine. They captured a lot of Ukrainian grain and farms, and they're selling it to their allies, and Syria being number one. Why is that a surprise? It's called war. That's how wars work. When, you know, the Israelis, everyone's like, why don't you give back the territory? Well, no, Israelis won four wars, and they get to keep stuff. So this notion that you're stealing the grain, it's called booty. I mean, if you know, or whatever you want to call it, but it comes as no surprise. And by the way, everyone's like, oh, Russia's only got a third of Ukraine. It may be a third of the territory, but it's close to 100% of the industrial capacity, with the exception of Odessa. All the steel plants, the mining, energy generation, the port facilities, all that stuff is in the strip, the land bridge from Russia to Crimea that the Russians have captured. So it may be a third of the land, but it's, as I say, closer to 70-80% of the economic capacity of the country.
What's going on? Like they recently defaulted on some of their debt. Like what was going on with that?
Well, a really good question. So that's the fine default. So they didn't pay. Okay. So that's a default, you know, technically. They wanted to pay. They had the money, but we wouldn't let them. We closed the payment channels. Okay. So they couldn't. All right. And that is a technical default. So tell me who wins. So last time I looked, if I'm the debtor and you tell me I don't have to pay you, I was like, well, thank you very much. I get to keep the money. Who loses? The creditors. Who are the creditors? Well, BlackRock. I mean, got any Russian bonds in your emerging markets ETF that was sold to you by Federated or Fidelity or Goldman or BlackRock? Take a look. You know, it might be in there. But in other words, the winner is the debtor who gets to keep the money, and the loser is the creditor who owns the bond that didn't get paid. So this is another good question, James, but another example of how we're hurting ourselves. All of our sanctions are not hurting Russia. They are hurting us. Now, the supply chain was breaking down before the war in Ukraine. And prices were going up, particularly in the energy sector, before the war in Ukraine. But Ukraine, the war is making it worse. There's no question about that.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs. And I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
What's actually happening then? So the Fed is not doing anything, but they are talking the stock market down. Stock market's going down, which I do think decreases velocity, but we'll see. And I'm hoping that the decrease in velocity will decrease inflation. So my theory is the Federal Reserve is talking inflation down because they know they can't actually do anything in addition to all the supply stuff going on. If inflation goes down a couple, like let's say we see in 2 or 3 months, the numbers are down because there's a recession, because the stock market's down, whatever, the Fed will kind of loosen their language a little bit, and that will be a positive thing for the markets. That's my overall simplified theory.
Well, that's like saying, I'm going to hit myself in the head with a hammer because it feels good when it stops. I mean, I agree.
That is what they're doing, yes.
Yeah, so... Okay, so you said the Fed can't stop inflation. Well, the Fed can't do anything about the supply side. You're right about that. I agree. They don't drill, last time I checked, they don't drill for oil. They don't drive tractors. They don't drive trucks. They don't unload cargo in Long Beach, and they don't pilot, you know, container cargo vessels across the Pacific. So the Fed can't do anything about the supply side, what's called cost push inflation. They can fight inflation one way, which is to utterly destroy demand. And this is what Paul Volcker did in 1980-81. You raise interest rates enough, mortgage rates go up, asset values go down, unemployment goes up, people are laid off, we're in a recession or worse. You know, maybe it tips into a financial panic. It's another subject, but there's a whole global liquidity crisis going on behind the curtain that very few people understand. But that may emerge, which is separate from the recession. So yeah, you destroy the economy, cause a severe recession bordering on depression level statistics, and inflation will go down. I agree with that. And in that world, the Fed will cut rates. But at what cost? I mean, just listen to what we just said. Yeah, I can get inflation under control by destroying it. I mean, Paul Volcker did it. That 1981-82 recession was, at the time, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Now, we've managed to surpass that since then, but at the time, that was the worst.
And I agree, Volcker was like a maniac with what he was doing. He had like one hammer and everything was a nail.
Right.
Well, my thinking now is that the Fed knows nothing works. Like, even Volcker-style raising rates, you'd have to raise rates that high to have any effect at all. So my thinking is the Fed wants to manipulate psychology more than actual money. Like, why would Powell say things like, we might have a hard landing? Like, the Fed never used to talk like that. They never used to predict landings. They would be as quiet as possible, and they would raise or decrease rates. Now they're like commenting. And the reason, my think is they're commenting because they want people to be depressed so that they stop buying and inflation goes down.
Yeah, you're right. And that is the old playbook. What do they call it? They used to call it forward, or they still call it forward guidance, jawboning, you know, a lot of names for it. Yeah, you're right about that. With one big difference, which is if it's demand driven, if it's demand pull inflation, if it's behavioral, then maybe jawboning and threatening bad things and we're going to raise rates until this economy slows down, maybe that works. But that's not what's happening. That's not where the inflation is coming from. Again,
I see.
Jawboning does not unclog the port of Los Angeles.
So you're right. So what you're describing essentially is the 70s. You're describing stagflation, which is inflation caused by supply. And everybody would love to buy, but now they don't even want to buy. But there's still inflation.
Right. Well, but the 70s had two phases. Phase one is the phase we're in now. That was the Arab oil embargo. Then in 79, you had the Iranian oil embargo. That was supply driven. That was cost pushed. But it morphed into demand pull. It morphed into behavioral changes and higher velocity. And the danger right now is that we've got the first one. The supply chain is messed up, cost push inflation, it's everywhere. It hasn't quite morphed to behavior because people are, they hate it, they don't like it, they know it's there, but they're kind of like, you know, maybe it'll go away.
Well, and they're depressed. They don't want to spend money.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. You see that in the velocity. The question is, does it persist long enough so that there is that you cross what physicists call the the critical threshold or phase transition, where somehow there's a catalyst and the demand pull inflation, the behavioral adaptations emerge. It hasn't happened yet, but it could. So you got to keep an eye on that. And then that would be a full replay of the 1970s, Act One and Act Two. But I agree that the Fed's trying to talk it down, but it won't work. And here's why. Because it's coming from the supply side. And, you know, again, someone not investing in the oil field because Biden's saying we're going to shut down oil in 5 years. Okay, I got a 10 to 15 year horizon on my investment, but you're going to shut it down in 5 years. I think I'll pass. Thank you. So that has nothing to do with the Fed. But the Fed's talking it down. It won't work. But if you raise interest rates enough, it will work. But as we described, at a very, very high cost.
You'd have to raise, and that's the whole ludicrous thing about 50 basis points or 75. You have to raise like 1,000 basis points for it to affect inflation.
You're right. We have the data. So basically, round numbers, real rates have to be about 2% to subdue inflation and slow the economy. So with inflation at 8.6, that means your nominal rate has to be 10.6.
Which it hasn't been since Volcker.
Correct. And 10.6 nominal, 8.6 inflation, your real rate is 2. That'll slow it down. Well, you're not going to get to 10.6. You're not going to get to 5.6. We'll be in the worst recession since, worse than 2008. That's where we'll be before you get to 5.
I agree, but I don't think they want to raise rates that much. I think that's why they're trying to jawbone it, as you say.
But I agree with what they're doing, James. I agree with that description, but all I'm saying is it'll fail.
So I'm wondering if they're just biding time because eventually the supply shocks caused by COVID will relax. I mean, maybe they won't, but it's just things have a tendency to get better, when the conditions that cause them stop. And eventually this war will be over, so that supply shock will be over. Like, could just natural events kind of ease this cost push inflation?
No, because I just read a book on this. It's coming out November 29th. The book's called Sold Out. It's available for pre-order on Amazon, but it's a really deep study on the supply chain. And I look at, I talked to the guy who built the supply chain, the number one guy. Nobody did this solo, but this guy had more, he's recognized in academia and government as like the man who built the supply chain. And he said to me, he said, Jim, you have to understand, it took us 30 years to build it. We blew it up in 3 years. It's not coming back in less than 5 or 10 years, at least, if not longer. In other words, this is Humpty Dumpty. You know, it breaks, but you can't put it back together. You can hatch a new egg over here, but that will take 5 to 10 years. So the answer is no. There's nothing the Fed can do about the supply chain. By the way, COVID played a role, but this if you really want to, I did do this research and I had very good sourcing. the supply chain really started to break down in 2018 with the trade war. It was really Trump's trade war and the tariffs on China. Now, I don't want to debate tariff policy. I happen to agree with it. But if you want to say, okay, when did shipping start to slow down? When did the ports start to get congested, et cetera? It wasn't COVID. It was the trade war. And things like China fighting back by saying, we're not buying any more U.S. soybeans. Okay, well, where are you going to get your soybeans? They bought them from Brazil. Brazil is the second largest producer after that. Brazil, Canada, and the U.S. are the three largest producers. Well, okay, but that's not like picking up a phone and saying, hey, send me some soybeans. You got transportation lanes, shipping channels that they built for 20 years. And the parties to that like 5-10 year contracts. They don't do it on a phone call. And so transferring all those lanes to Brazil from the West Coast of the United States took years. But once you do it, here's my point. Once you do it, you don't flip back. They're just going to keep buying soybeans from Brazil. So these and with more costs involved because of all the frictions and what I just described. And so that stuff doesn't turn on a dime. You can't break it and rebuild it very easily. And it had nothing to do with COVID. So the answer is it's going to persist, and it is.
So what's next?
What's next is and this goes by different names. I write about it in my new book in the conclusion. Janet Yellen calls it friendshoring, and Macron calls it he has some name for collegiality or something. But the point is, we're still going to have supply chains. We're still going to have extended supply chains. Nobody can be autarkic, or at least not very efficiently. But they're going to be confined to groups of friends. So liberal democracies. So China will be cut out, will be decoupled. So Australia, the US, Canada, Western Europe, UK, South Africa, New Zealand, another set of countries can trade with each other because they'll uphold, they won't have slavery, they won't have genocide, they'll uphold some liberal democratic values, small d Democrat. And then China will have to go figure out their own supply chain with whatever, dictatorships they can find. But we're not going to do business with China, which, supports organ harvesting from live patients without anesthetic who happen to be political enemies, killing 20 million girls with bedside buckets who drowned at birth, slavery, genocide. Again, I work hard not to buy, Nike shoes, for example.
And I agree with you on China. Everything you say about China, 100%. I did a podcast with General Spalding, who was a top China advisor in the last administration, and he says the same things. My question is, are we dependent on China for anything? For instance, rare earth minerals. They are the largest source of rare earth minerals. We need rare earth minerals to power our grid, to turn on any semiconductor. You need rare earth minerals. What happens if they say, hey, we're just not selling you those anymore?
It's fine. I mean, first thing about rare earths are not rare. They're called rare earths because when you mine them, the density is low. There's just a little bit in whatever ton of ore, but they're everywhere. So basically, we'll have to expand our rare earth mining capacity. And there's tons of, we got all we need in Colorado, but try getting past the green new scamsters. I mean, that's the problem. We've got all the energy we need. We got all the rare earths we need. We got all the hydro we need. We got everything we need. I'm not arguing for no extended supply chains. I think we'll have that as along the lines I described. We don't, but if you ask, are we in fact dependent on China today? The answer is yes. Do we have to be going forward? The answer is no. By the way, there's a very good report on this, and I mentioned my book sold out. There's a group called the Five Eyes. I'm sure you know who they are. The Five Eyes are five countries that are close enough that they actually share intelligence, and intelligence agencies don't like to share with each other. But Australia, Canada, New Zealand, US, and the UK, they're the Five Eyes. And again, it's an intelligence, condo, if you want to think of it that way. But they've kind of branched out, and there's a new report, but it's all on trade dependency. And I just call it the Five Eyes report. It has some technical name, but it's a footnote in my book. But I write about it a lot. And so they did a study. They took approximately 5,400 product categories from some standardized indices and kind of taxonomies of products. They then looked at where they came from, who produced them and who bought them. And they set a couple parameters. They said, okay, do you get more than 50% of this from the sole supplier? And does that sole supplier produce more than 80% of the global output? They set a couple of parameters that define dependency for this purpose. And then they ran the numbers and it was shocking. The results were shocking. Don't get a hangover in New Zealand. They get 100% of their aspirin from China. But on a more serious note, you know, laptop computers, cell phones.
All our pharmaceuticals come from China, don't they?
A great deal of them, absolutely right. Penicillin, aspirin, a lot else. So, but the thing I liked about it was that it was rigorous, empiric, data-driven, and quantifiable. But they showed, what was interesting is the UK was a little less dependent, but Australia, New Zealand, the United States, all heavily dependent on China for these goods. And so, but the good thing about it gives you a target set. It tells you what you need to onshore. Or friendshore, you know, I don't have to make it in the United States, but I better make it in Australia or Canada. Although Canada is going fascist pretty quickly, but you have to work with your friends, not with your enemies, and I think that's the way to put it.
Jim, it's fascinating to hear your insights. You know so much, and I've already been taking notes on like which authors to read and which books to read. But how can people find you? And you know, you write articles on a very frequent basis. How do people sign up for you?
Thank you. My flagship newsletter is called Strategic Intelligence. It's a great value. It comes out once a month. It's about 5,000 words, so I put a lot into it. But it's a very attractive price point. But if you just Google, you know, James Rickard, Strategic Intelligence, you'll find it. Some Paradigm Press. They're my publisher. I have some other specialized newsletters. Believe me, you'll get an email about those. But Strategic Intelligence is our pride and joy. That's our flagship. And I have a new book coming out, Sold Out. It's available for pre-order on Amazon.
Will you come on again when Sold Out comes out?
I would love to. That'll be October, November. Would love to come back.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Jim, for joining us. I mean, you've explained a lot. I understand things a lot better. And look, I always hope for the best. I always tell people if there's a good company that's innovating and creating things, there's nothing wrong with investing it. Don't try to game the entire market. The market as a whole has so many factors and a lot of them are scams that I don't trust it. But look, I'm nervous about the economy and inflation and so on. I don't think anybody knows what they're doing. And it's refreshing to hear your insights into this. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.